The discussion to address some important points, I think. And the first point is what are we actually looking for. Glass can do very well in an energy range between 100 MeV and maybe 200 GeV. So we can search for dark matter in these specific range of energies. And I will start by saying a few words about what we think we know about dark matter candidates, just to give an idea of what kind of candidates we can probe with glass. And I will not spend much time on the second part I had thought about when preparing this discussion, because I think that most of the key points of glass has been discussed, like the angle resolution and effective area and these kind of things, and even a nice talk given by Michael. And I would like to discuss with you this last point, how to convince a particle physicist that you have discovered dark matter with gamma ray observation. So imagine that you have a detection of gamma rays from satellites. How can you prove this is dark matter, and what you can learn actually on the nature of dark matter?
Dark matter.
So what do we know about dark matter? We know a bunch of things. Of course, we don't know what the nature of dark matter is, and as we will see, the range of scattering cross section and annihilation cross section is just almost completely unconstrained. But there are a few things we know, and when we try to understand what dark matter is made of, well, in particular, when we propose new candidates for dark matter, the first and foremost constraint is the one on the Rayleigh density. So whatever candidate you have in mind that comes from whatever extensions of the standard model of particle physics, you have to reproduce the correct Rayleigh abundance. And we know this quantity at a level of a few percent now with cosmological observations, by a combination of cosmological observations. We know that this particle is cold, this cold can be made very precise. We know that it must be close to non-relativistic at the epoch of structure formation. We know that some problems of the cold dark matter paradigm can be addressed or solved if we add some power on small scale. So for example, if dark matter is not really cold but warm. But it's actually very difficult, even in the framework of warm dark matter, to solve the problems of cold dark matter. Like, for instance, if you try to explain the presence of cores in dwarf galaxies and the number of structures and these kind of things, it's kind of difficult to do it with, KV particles, for instance.
We want to know cores in dwarf galaxies, so.
Sorry?
Nobody knows there are cores in dwarf galaxies, so.
But you know that this has been, the fact that warm dark matter, I mean, the presence of warm dark matter was invoked to explain this kind of issue. We want our particle to be neutral, and, we know that this must be the case. This endpoint test can be made very precise. Then we want our particle to be consistent with the Fermi nucleosynthesis, so no funny decay at early times and these kind of things. There's a lot of activity these days on the effect of dark matter on stars. I think we have two talks tomorrow morning on, I think that they will focus in particular on the effect on population 3 stars. So it's a field that is really bursting these days.
Did you have axions?
Sorry?
Do you have in mind axions?
No. I have in mind weakly interacting massive particles, like neutralinos.
How do they affect the evolution of the star?
The idea is that, well, there are two dedicated talks tomorrow, so we're not saying much. But the key point is that you have a very high density of these particles in the environment where these stars form. And from annihilation of these particles, you inject energy. And you have to keep into account this this fact in the energy budget of the star. So this, in some regions,
this is matter captured by the star,
exactly.
And annihilating inside.
Yes. So you have two effects. You have a third one. Paul will tell us more about this tomorrow morning. But even before you have captured, from the very fact that these halos are, collapsing, and this is exactly really where the star begins to form. then you can have from annihilation an injection of energy, and then from capture of dark matter on stars, you can see that have further modifications of the structure and the evolution of the star.
So this is the same constraint we used to get from the sun, right?
The idea is the same.
The sun is something. It's different. The sun, you get a capture in the sun,
yeah,
and create. You have radiation coming out as between beams. The effect on the stellar evolution is different. Where you could have either the same capture mechanism, or you could simply have a contraction of the dark halo.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just trying to remember from the sun. I thought there was a limit based on the central temperature of the sun. Is that related to the neutrino limit?
Well, there are a number of constraints that come in, even from heliospace monopsy stars on these particles. But they're not good enough to throw the supersymmetric for our space.
Okay.
They're so weakly interacting that they don't affect the temperature of the sun in any sensitive way.
I thought it was just something where you were leveraging T to the 26 or whatever it is.
That's true, and by the way, some models called cosmians in the far past that it would affect the central temperature of the sun. But with the current dark matter mechanics and particle physics, the effect is still present.
There can be constraints around the space, but not the symmetric model.
Yep.
Do you want to continue this, or do you want to be continually interrupted?
I want to be interrupted.
My other question is, what is the picture for number three?
It's kind of nice, though.
It is nice.
It's a pulse. I think I Googled the charge.
Okay.
So our underground detector is number 10?
Yes. So this is simulation of isolation
at LHC. So can I ask you, so do we expect axions to affect the stars in any way?
There are actually very interesting constraints that come from an argument that I think has been put forward by Russell on the amount of energy that is carried away by axions.
By axions,
yes.
So there's an upper limit.
Yes.
Do you want to consider the possibility that there are many kinds of dark matter? Some WIMPs, some axions,
absolutely,
some neutrinos.
So one thing that we need to be addressing in that scenario is, it is probably, my guess is that it is probably the case, but I would be surprised if different species managed to have comparable relic densities today. I mean, probably because they would decouple with very different physical mechanisms.
Yeah. Although we have so many coincidences.
Sure.
That's actually a paper, you know, that Frank Field 6 of.
It means that we might have some hot dark matter.
Absolutely. We have, we have
neutrinos.
We want our particles to be collisionless.
More or less. Wind might be a component that is collisional.
Sure, and I mean, we're collisionless in the sense that we can constrain the dark matter baryon interaction with dynamical arguments like the bullet cluster. And that we want to.
The underground detectors.
Yes. Now this is also a very interesting. A very interesting constraint you get on this from this type of argument. The other interesting thing is that if you draw the scattering cross section versus the scattering cross section versus mass plot,
there's a box there. It's just behind your computer. Just behind.
Okay. So if you draw this plot, sigma. I cannot see much. Anyway, so can you see here?
Mm-hmm.
Mass of the particle. Now, we always see the bottom part of this plot, so we see typically like exclusion plots of this kind, which means that everything is ruled out above this line. And typically, you go down through cross sections of the order 10 to the minus 36 or 38 centimeters squared. Actually, there is if you plot the actual region, which is excluded by underground experiment, it is something like this. So there is an upper limit to this region, which comes from the fact that particles that interact more strongly than a certain cross section wouldn't make it to the detector without potential energy, so they would not reflect into energy recoil of Utah in the detector. But fortunately, you have a number of arguments and a number of experiments that is sort of brought like this, and then you have astrophysical constraints up here, like the disruption of the DSM brings an argument. So you're pretty convinced that at least if the dark matter particle is between, let's say, above 1 GeV or so, the constraints in this plane are so strong and so many that the particle should really be weakly interacting, very, very weakly interacting.
Actually, I've always wondered that. Are there constraints on... There must be some constraints on the particle being strongly interacting in the strong force sense.
From the CMB, there's constraints on how strong it can be.
Where did this come from?
Just from the CMB, if you make the dark matter interact very strongly with the baryons.
No, sorry, I'm thinking of the... Well, I mean, I guess maybe it's the same thing, but if it has a strong force charge, like the
color elements,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this would bound with nuclei and do a sort of... actually, if you
read... nucleosynthesis basically tells
you... Nucleosynthesis, but also if you take a look at this paper, when we say it's neutral, you know, it cannot have any charge. Like
okay.
Because you make heavy nuclei.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anomalous heavy nuclei, and there's like really stringent limits on anomalous, you know, A to Z ratio or something like that. It's a very strong question.
So this paper of Spergel and Steinhardt has strong the self-interacting dark matter. I think the original version was a strong interaction, but you're saying that's ruled out or very constrained.
No, that was just self-interactions.
This was self-interactions.
But the cross-section was like the strong cross-section, I believe. But
it's ruled out anyhow by the A-studies and your clusters.
That's true.
Wow. Perhaps going to accept strongly self-interacting dark matter, you think, tend to make the clusters round. And you just observe with chakra, and they're not round.
Well, you believe anything from clusters?
Well, yeah, and then probably you have emerged from clusters.
There's no chance about itself on that model. And then to give an idea of how strong these cross sections would be, this would really give the macroscopic impact. So if these particles are self-annihilating, so if you make the hypothesis that these are self-annihilating, then in this region of the Brownian space, the heat produced by annihilation in the Earth would exceed the heat, the observed geological heat. Okay, so it's really huge.
This is great. This is like Bernard Carr's, you know, cratering right on the moon and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are limits to the dark matter particles that produce craters on the moon and stuff.
I was just wondering about the
ionization. It's like there's a whole operation
for ionization for gamma rays and so on. I mean,
well, really, this will be up.
But I think one should keep in mind that there are actually three kinds of particle dark matter. Type 1A, type 1B, and type 2.
That's hilarious.
The type 1A is the particles that exist, and there's no candidate that has survived. The type 2B is particles that have a particle physics reason to exist, hypothetical, but they're embedded in a genuine particle physics model. Type 2 is all the rest, all the things you can come up with cross-section maps. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to keep this distinction. In category 2B, or those that are hypothetical by embedded, are the axion and supersymmetric particles, like neutralino. And they, perhaps some models of polluted high particles with extra dimensions, and the rest you can easily put into category 2.
I missed the definition of 1A.
1A is those that really exist, like neutrinos.
Oh, okay.
So neutrinos used to be the candidate for the dark matter until the masses were measured. And now the top dark matter is the non-whole dark matter.
And they are not a minuscule fraction of the total.
They're not a minuscule fraction of the omega. They're quite sizable. But they cannot be whole dark matter. Because they free stream. The masses are very tiny, below a fraction of an electron ball.
Okay, so you can probably assign type 1A and type 2, you know, to these to all the different candidates that have been proved by Bayer and Tata on the cross section versus mass plane. And as you can see, I want to read you the numbers here. This is 10 to the minus 39 up to 10 to the 24. Uncertainty, interaction, cross-section, 10 to the minus 33, up to the 10 to the 11 GeV in mass. So this is clearly, you know, an embarrassing situation.
So none of these are ruled out, or?
No, I think these are, things like neutrinos, of course, you know, they cannot be the dark matter, but, you know, axions can be dark matter, axions, gravitinos, winzillas, you know, these very heavy particles produced gravitationally, certainly they could.
But these are all type 1B.
No.
You need a separate graph for type 1B, or type 2.
A winzilla, for example, don't have a particle that isn't small.
Which one?
Winzilla, on the right. They don't have it. Quasi CDM doesn't have a particle physics model.
Q balls have, I suppose, right?
What is a Q?
I don't know. Yeah, what is a Q ball?
Balls. Well, stretch
it. I think it's not, you know, the main point of the discussion. Okay. So, but, you know, you know, we have cosmological and astrophysical constraints on different quantities, and for each of the, you know, once you specify your particle physics model, you can test your model, and you can constrain annihilation cross section, decay time, and things like that. So we focus on when we do, and I mean the main importance of GLAS is that we search for very well modulated candidates, and the idea is very simple. You all know about this, but this is a crucial point, and I want to stress this. The fact that we are considering annihilating particles in the local universe is that we have in mind a mechanism by which these dark matter particles achieve the correct density in the early universe because of these annihilation cross-sections. So you have self-annihilation into standard model particles. And for annihilation cross-sections of the order of the 10 to the minus 26 centimeter cubed times minus 1, you achieve the correct density. Now, in the parameter space of supersymmetry, for instance, you typically achieve the correct density by different mechanisms, by co-annihilations and things alike. But we always have this number in mind when we do phenomenological studies. We have seen what the dependence of the flux on the different quantities is. So the number of photons produced per annihilation, annihilation cross-section, mass of the particle, an integral over the density square. And I think I can safely skip this, but you know, I just wanted to show this slide that I had shown in the Pascos talk, just to give an idea to those who are, you know, far from particle physics. The reason why most people are actually interested in these supersymmetric models or universal extra dimensions models is that they have a robust theory behind them. So they're not just stuff that we invented to explain dark matter. These really have pretty profound motivations, like to explain the hierarchy problem in particle physics, and these are possible extensions of the standard model. Now, if we just plot all the particles of the standard model down here, so quarks, leptons, gauge bosons, so everything is observed and measured with very good accuracy. We don't know exactly the masses of the neutrinos, but we measure the mass differences, and we hope to see the Higgs at the LHC. In the most naive extension, well, in the most naive representation of current essentials of the standard model, you have partners to each of the standard model particles, and these are, for instance, the so-called sporks in supersymmetry and selectors. Then you have partners to the gauge process. And this is where typically the wing enters as a combination. It's a linear combination of the partners of the gauge bosons in supersymmetry, and in the most simple version of universal lesser dimensions is the first excited state of this B host. So this new energy of physics is around, hopefully, 100 GeV or so, and will be probed at accelerators like the LHC. And everything can be made very precise. For theories like supersymmetry, you can write Lagrangians, you can calculate amplitudes and these kind of things. So this is real robust physics if it applies to reality, actually, which is something we don't know. Whether it's supersymmetry or extra dimensions, you have viable dark matter candidates with typically a mass of the order 100 GeV, GeV or so, and weak cross sections. And this is the stuff we will be looking for with indirect searches. Now, we are discussing gamma rays here, but keep in mind that there is a number of different techniques and different experiments. So here is GLASS. This is Pamela, and this Pamela satellite is an antimatter satellite that has accumulated now more than a year and a half of data. And they have presented some of their data in conferences already, and I think they have submitted at least a paper on antiprotons already. This is HESS, and then you have neutrino telescopes like Antares and LASCI. Now, the excitement about GLASS is because of this reason. So if you just plot the energy of X-ray and gamma-ray experiments as a function of time, you see that in the last 20 years, we had in the interesting energy range, like 1 to 100 GeV, we had the egress from 92 to 2000, so then nothing, essentially, until 2008. And this is where GLASS will be taking data, and this is really the energy range where we could observe some interesting signals from dark matter. Now, we have seen most of these properties of GLASS in the talk of Michael. We have seen the energy range, the effective area, we said it's like 8,000 centimeters squared or so. One of the big improvements of GLASS over EGRET is the angular resolution. And this is extremely important to resolve foreign sources, increase the sensitivity, and typically get at energies worth of 1 GeV or so, you have PSF worth of 0.1 degrees or so, so a factor of 10 improvement over EGRET. The energy resolution will be order like 10% or so. So since one of the interesting things you hope to detect is the annihilation lines, then you have to keep in mind that you will measure a line with an uncertainty, with a width, experimental width of 10% or so. One of the nicest features of GLASS is that it's really a full sky. It will produce full sky surveys. So we have gamma ray telescopes on Earth. We have Air Chernikov telescopes, for instance. But the big limitation for dark matter searches is that their field of view is tiny. So it's like a few degrees. The field of view of GLASS is two steradian. So it's really big. And this is the simulated 5 years exposure, 100 GeV. And you see that it is actually quite uniform. So it is 2, 10 to 11, 2.5, 10 to 11. It's pretty uniform over the whole scan. And by simulations, I don't want to steal the show to our friends. There's simulation, and I'm sure that Jörg will show you these nice movies that are posted on their website. But for the sake of the discussion, let me just say that, well, we have already seen that the most interesting targets for the dark matter searches, but this is the whole simulated Milky Way halo. We have the galactic center, and then substructures, and maybe a diffuse emission that we could be searching for. Now, for what concerns the galactic center, it is important to notice that the galactic center has been observed already by different experiments, by IGRET and by Air Chamber of Telescopes, and we know that there are sources of gamma rays at the galactic center. So when we make predictions for GLASS, we have always to keep in mind that the galactic center has been observed. This is the spectrum of the source observed by GLASS. This coincides within better than with a precision is better than 0.1 degrees to the Sagittarius A star. And the spectrum, as you can see, extends from say 200 GeV up to 20 or 30 GeV, and it is rather, it can be well fixed by a simple power law over 2 decades, essentially. Now, people have tried to play the game to overimpose an annihilation spectrum on top of these data points, but it's sort of difficult to reproduce the data over 2 decades with an annihilation spectrum, which typically does not look like a power law. And then you also need some values of the mass, for instance, that are really extreme, at least for the particle physics model that we have in mind, so we're at 30 TeV or so. This study is taken by, this is a paper of Stefano Profumo, and what he tried to do is to try to see with a combination of different annihilation channels, you could reproduce the has a spectrum over 2 decades in energy, and I think the green line is the best you can do with just letting the branching ratios as free parameters and adjusting them in order to fit the Hess data points.
The mass was what? 30 GeV.
The mass, well, it's at least 10 TeV is probably well above, like 20 or 30 TeV. But then, you know, this is...
Is that going to get a lot better? I'm just thinking, if you have to wait 2 or 3 years for GLASS to integrate, what's that curve like?
So, first of all, GLASS will take data until energy is like below this energy center. Good data. Mm-hmm. So it's going to improve the data up here.
And I'm just thinking that Hess error bars have shrunk quite a lot going from 1 to 2 years. So I presume they're just going to continue integrating on this.
Sure. But you see what the main problem is here. I mean, even if you find a model that can fit the data, so what? I mean, it's how can you convince anyone that this is dark matter annihilation?
Yeah. I was thinking more just the other way that the blue points don't look like a straight line anymore. So in a way, if you found a model where you see 3 or 4 different components, it's much more useful for driving it.
Yeah.
Foregrounds and stuff.
Yeah, that's probably true. The better the data, the more detailed studies you can get. But from the point of view, really, of the interpretation or discovery of dark matter, well, you can still hope to have a signal, so to use these as an astrophysical source, and try to see whether you can hope to discover dark matter at energies below the threshold of S. And this, Dan Cooper and Gabriel, there is a successful attempt with this game. And I think this this plot is particularly interesting. It's one of the key points, I think, of the discussion. This is the constraints you can set on the annihilation cross-section versus mass from different experiments. So the top, like in this yellow region up here, the flux would exceed the data taken by egrets. This is the sensitivity of glass, meaning that below this line, glass cannot see anything from the galactic center. And this is excluded by the observations of Hess. So the key point here is that the potential discovery, the window of opportunity, the potential discovery of glass is in this white region here.
So what do you mean by galactic center? Now, it's just you're focusing on the central Kula parsec or something?
Yeah, we are really considering a central beam.
Central beam, okay. Yes. But there could be, you could discover dark matter in looking another direction.
Sure, this is just for the galactic center. So you're looking at 0.1 degrees.
It depends upon what you use for the density profile.
Yeah,
like very sensitive.
To like three orbs of
magnitude.
Yeah. Easily get
-27.
No, but these are not predictions of what the flux would be.
No, I mean just exclusion.
Sure. Certainly. But in any case, I mean, this was a shift up and down both first. So the fact that the window is narrow is valid no matter what the profile is.
That's a good point.
This is the key point I wanted to make.
That's a good point.
So you would change the absolute value on that axis, basically.
Yeah, exactly. This happens when you transform fluxes into an annihilation cross-section. That requires the knowledge of the internal non-domain of sound.
Just a stupid question. What if you detect somehow dark matter with a very low annihilation cross section?
Well, we can do that.
How do you go back and fix cosmology anymore?
Oh, we can, achieve the correct density with quantum annihilation.
If you find it's 10 to minus 27.
I can fix that. A more interesting strategy is instead of focusing on really the central beam, is to look at the diffuse emission in what is called an annulus around the galactic center. And several people have played this game. I think one of the first was Stir, a collaborator in 2002. And there was recently a paper by Celtic and Zarevitas that they did the analysis for different profiles. The point is that it is true that the largest signal from annihilation comes from the center. But it's also true that the sensitivity of glass is worse towards the galactic center because of astrophysical backgrounds. Okay? So the idea is to compare signal and background in order to maximize the signal to noise. And you can play this game, and this is the size of the outer ring then maximizes the signal-to-noise for different profiles. So they have taken like an R to the minus 1.5 profile, so-called Moore, and Navarro Franken wide and a cap of a profile. This is a profile with a rather flat core.
So what is the cap of profile?
It's a profile that goes like R to the minus 4.4 or something.
Oh, by far.
Yeah, it's very shallow towards the center. Mm-hmm. And when you move from steep to shallow, the region, of course, where you have to integrate over becomes larger and larger. But for like an outer flanker like profile, you have a typical size of order 2 degrees you want to integrate over to get the maximum signal to noise ratio. And I don't remember what the dashed line is. That is changing the size of the inner ring. I don't remember exactly.
Signal to noise there was just square root of background as a noise?
Yes. But it's the square root of the sum of the signal plus background.
Which in principle may be a little bit too pessimistic if you have some energy discrimination.
Sure. But keep in mind that typically you get very few photons, so it's going to be difficult to use that as information. Now we have discussed dark matter substructures. We have maybe 10 more minutes, and we should go on rapidly towards the second part of the discussion, which is what you can learn actually from this kind of observation. But we've heard about substructures, and I will not spend much time on that. This is the problem that I mentioned earlier. What can you learn actually from in general from astrophysical observations? You know that from what we have just seen, there is an uncertainty. If you just plot a generic annihilation flux, like the flux of gamma rays from dark matter annihilation as a function of energy. Now, you know that you can shift the predicted profiles left or right by changing the mass of the dark matter particle. You can move these profiles up and down by changing the normalization, the profile, and the annihilation cross-section. You can change the shape by changing the nature of the dark matter. So if it annihilates into electrons and positrons or directly to gamma rays and these kind of things. So anytime there is an excess in astrophysics, there will be always someone who will try to use this ambiguity in the predictions to fit the data. Mm-hmm. So how can you convince anyone that you have found dark matter? And in fact, people have played this game many times. With different, let's forget about the first point, which is the gamma detection, but the other, even particles with masses over the anemic or so, which is very far from the predictions of supersymmetry, for instance, have been proposed in order to explain the integral line at 111 kV. The galactic, in order to explain the GeV excess towards the center, towards the galactic center, supersymmetric dark matter has been people have tried to interpolate the data or to explain the data, to feed the data with dark supersymmetric dark matter, and then the test source, the WMAP case, as we know, and the peak position flux, and then all these. Could be actually a signature of dark matter, but it is so far, certainly it cannot be used as proofs that the dark matter is there. It can be sometimes even very well, the dark matter provides very good fits to this data, but this is not conclusive anyway. So how do you convince a particle physicist? Well, these are some ideas, but I would like also to have your feedback. Maybe the most convincing signature would be the observation in gamma rays, for example, of an annihilation line. If you find a line at 235 GeV, this is not something that astrophysics can do, and the GLAS, the dark matter group, has put a lot of effort into the study of how to discriminate lines and define lines at energies probably up to 200 GeVs or so. It's going to be difficult to do much better at higher energies. And different people have made the predictions for different candidates. And GLAS is certainly the experiment you want to use for this kind of studies.
So in these minimal SUSY models, is this possible even?
Typically, no. Sorry. But there are other models where this could be possible.
No, just the line signal. It's typically suppressed.
It's typically suppressed. With respect to the continuum, for instance.
Sir? Yeah, that's so is it possible to see it in absorption somehow?
How would you do that?
I mean, if you have a gamma ray source, for example,
you would need an interaction between photons and dark matter.
But you have it.
But in this case, you have the high densities of dark matter. You do dark matter to photons.
Yeah.
But I don't think.
So it hasn't been really thought, or is it just completely ridiculous this model?
I mean, suspect it's extremely small, but I never checked an absorption, like interaction of a photon with a dark matter particle.
It's negligible.
Because that, I guess diffuse sources in astrophysics are usually seen in absorption rather than emission. I'm just thinking that.
Huge column depth. You'll have to have a huge column depth of dark matter.
Yeah. But is it like a resonance? Like, I guess, but you're saying even for the.
Okay, so spectral lines or multiple sources. And the multiple sources could be substructures of dark matter, or it could be something different. And we have spent some time with Andrew discussing about the possibility to detect black holes. And the reason why black holes are interesting, well, we know that in astrophysics, black holes are divided into stellar mass, intermediate mass black holes, and supermassive black holes. These are the guys sitting at the center of big galaxies, and there is very good evidence for this object. Stellar mass black holes are also, we have robust evidence although not smoking gun, but robust evidence for these objects. Intermediate mass black holes are a bit more speculative, but they come out in many astrophysical scenarios. And the reason why this is interesting is the following. In 2000, people have studied the behavior of stars for collision and collisionless matter around a black hole. And Paolo and Joseph have studied in 2000 what happens to the distribution of dark matter around a supermassive black hole. Well, around the black hole, that grows from a seed up to the current mass. So you start from a small seed, you go up to, for instance, 10 to the 6 solar masses, and you study how the distribution of dark matter around this object responds to the increased gravitational potential wave.
It's growing by the accretion of dark matter particles, or just?
Sorry, it's giving you a pretty typical ordinary variance. And you can, if you do the ansatz that the final distribution is a power law, you can easily relate the final power law just for conservation of mass and angular momentum to the initial power. And it is easy to prove that within the radius of gravitational influence of the black hole, the profile becomes much steeper. So typically, if you plug in a very frank and white gamma equal 1, this gamma spikes in times 7 over 3, so 2.3. Since the problems depend on rho squared, this means a very large enhancement of the annihilation flux. The problem is that at the galactic center, it's going to is very difficult for that. Is, I mean, it's unlikely that such an overdensity would have survived. You see that if you focus on these blue lines here, so this is the radius of gravitational influence of the supermassive black hole at the galactic center, which is typically a particle zone, and this is the density of dark matter. So this is a Navarro-Franke-White profile, so r to the minus 1. This is how the profile would get modified by the growth of the black hole. So this is the so-called spike. Now, if you include the effect of stars, so the fact that there is a stellar cusp at the galactic center that scatters off, essentially dark matter, you see that the density of dark matter will be reduced by a couple of orders of magnitude. And if you further include the fact that these particles annihilate, then you end up with this dotted line that is the final profile, which is, larger, but not by a lot, by a simple with respect to a simple extrapolation of a Navarro-Franke-White profile down to small scales. So this sort of unlikely that this such a large of advances would have survived at the galactic center, but maybe if at least in some specific formation scenarios, which if you're interested, I can give you details on. But at least in some astrophysical scenarios, we have studied with Andrew Rosanna and Joseph. You have a number of detectable sources as a function of you can think of this as the sensitivity of a given experiment above one GeV, you see that we made predictions for two different dark matter candidates, so an optimistic case and a pessimistic case. And we have compared our predictions with sensitivity of egret in glass. And you see that in one case, at least, well, let's take the pessimistic case, the number of sources would have been order 10 for egret and order 100 with glass. Probably models that lead to 100 sources detectable with egret are already ruled out by the fact that egret has observed unidentified sources, but it is unlikely that this makes that this population of object may contribute significantly to the population of unidentified sources. And plus, we have looked into the Hess data. So Hess has performed a scan of the sky towards the galactic center, and the absence of interesting candidates constrain quite severely, actually, the scenario of intermediate mass black holes. But then, who knows? The nice thing about these objects is really that they would be point sources with an identical spectrum, not correlated with the disk, and so this would be like a quite spectacular signature of dark matter.
Do you assume here that there's no stellar crust around the intermediate mass black hole?
Exactly, yeah. You're supposing that the number that
it's just dark matter.
Yes, yes. And we have excluded from our analysis all the black holes that merge with the central black hole or among each other. So
they're not even a cluster.
Exactly. Okay, so the last couple of slides. The third strategy for an ambiguous identification. Well, this is more delicate, but I think it is an interesting possibility. Is to perform multi-wetland studies. So, for instance, if you manage to say reproduce the WMAP case in microwave wetlands, then you use the same profile and same properties of the dark matter to predict a signal for glass and see whether glass really observes these kind of features. So you can do like this is the well, you have energies here that range from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the 5 MeV, and you can try to build for dark matter annihilations. And maybe this, but certainly this constraint is much better. The overall scenario that you have in mind, but keep in mind also that you have to add further uncertainties, like the magnetic field and things like that. And fourth, this is something that Gaius had mentioned in a question earlier today. When you study, of course, you can calculate the gamma ray background produced by annihilations of dark matter in all the structures of the universe. And for some parameters, you can even try to, well, you can even hope that it fits the egret observed or egret induced, deduced by the egret data. But this is not a smoking gun. I mean, if you still have this. Bumps in the spectrum. So you can do go for a more sophisticated approach and do the angular power spectrum the same way you do for the cosmic microwave background. And this has been done by Ando and Komatsu in 2006. And they have shown that if the dark matter contributes significantly to the cosmic microwave, the gamma ray background, then glass should be able to discriminate dark matter origin from an astrophysical origin of this spectrum. So I think these are the four strategies I could think of, at least with gamma rays. And these are some concluding thoughts. So realistic dark matter scenarios detectable signals in glass. I think this is actually exciting. The fact that finally, after years of decades for some speculation, we are finally ready to analyze some data. And we need to be lucky to see something, because there is a window, an interesting window where fluxes are not in excess of what EGRET has observed, but they are still within the reach of glass. I think that there is a factor of maybe 30 or so in sensitivity, where this between EGRET and glass, where there could be a natural detection. And but to obtain an ambiguous, even if we get these signals, in order to obtain an ambiguous evidence, we need to be smart and also to be very, very lucky. And well, time speculation is almost over, so I'll get ready to analyze some data and comments.
So the window sensitivity for
blocks
compared to the
parameters
based data
other teams
can look at?
So I don't have I know certainly, well, the glass collaboration in general, they show the in the property space of supersymmetry, where you always have to specify the framework
when you analyze.
So if you are in the framework of supersymmetry, you can go in the plane in 0 and 1 half, like the common mass of stars and neutrinos, and look at the regions which can be accessed by LHC, for instance, by events with missing energy and these kind of things. And you can compare this with the sensitivity of glass, the regions which will produce an observable flux in with glass. And I need to check that it's a bit more dependent, but there are regions. I think it's difficult to find regions where glass can see signals that are not models that cannot be observable at LHC.
So the LHC parameter space there is bigger.
Yeah. Well, but then it's difficult to say because there are astrophysical uncertainties behind. Yeah. So you're comparing different things. You're forcing different strategies. The comparison of different strategies, which are done under different assumptions or independent assumptions, at least.
So it'd be interesting enough to add the my impression as a complete non-expert from the Pascal's particle physics talks was the data analysis for which she is really non-trivial. And you know, if you know exactly what your model is and it's that model, then it's fine. But you can very easily wander off into theory space where you have no idea whether you're seeing event or not because you're not triggering on it, or because and that at a minimum with LHC, you know, it could easily be 4 or 5 years before you know that. I thought they just turned the thing on. You get a big peak there. But apparently not. I mean, apparently it's a lot harder than that.
It's going to be very, very difficult.
And they have all sorts of quite standard scenarios where you're going to be really hard to test your eye rather than anything like that. Far less getting you across the part.
Yeah, even if you fix your theoretical framework, the constraints that you get on the masses and couplings at the LHC will not allow you, in most of the parameter space, to pinpoint, for instance, the dark matter particle. I mean, you can say that there is, that you observe a spectrum of supersymmetric, for instance, particles or new particles in general. And you can, try to compare the pattern that you're observing with your theory. Can see some regularities in this pattern that, point to some specific implementation of supersymmetry, for instance. Also, because supersymmetry is just—it's really a framework. It's not a model that gives actual predictions. But even if you try to interpret all this data into a specific theoretical framework, like minimal supersymmetry. It's going to be difficult to say whether the lightest supersymmetric particle is actually the dark matter or not. Mm-hmm. Because it's going to be difficult for instance to reconstruct the relative density of this point.
So following on Gene's question, say LHC does see something, that's something like missing energy or something in some interaction. How do you know, or can you say something about translating that into the same thing that causes lensing and the same thing that glass sees? How do you know what you're seeing if LHC is the same dark matter that we're talking about aspect ratio?
Well, the first thing that the people will try to do is to precisely to try to solve the image problem and to infer the properties in general of these particles well enough to determine the relative density of this particle.
So can you do anything beyond determining relative density?
I cannot think of anything. Well, this is the first and foremost thing that you need to do.
So I have an important announcement, which is there's a threat with our cup right now get eaten by someone else. So not wanting to cut the discussion short, maybe we can all move
to this cup.